On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
Now, this week brings the anniversary on May the 12th, the last Wednesday, of the first International Dublin Theatre Festival. It opened back in 1957 with a play called The Rose Tattoo. It was a Tennessee Williams classic, and it had previously played to packed houses on Broadway and all around the world. But in a tiny theatre that could hold just a few dozen seats, the play, when it was staged in Dublin, caused a panic that went right to the top of Irish society. It included the Catholic Archbishop and the Attorney General, and it was all to do with a fairly important prop in the story, which led to a Garda raid and the prosecution of the owner of the theatre. That controversial prop is a condom. And Donal Fallon is here in studio to tell us all about it. Donal, you're welcome back. It's good to see you in the flesh for the first time in what genuinely seems like years and years and years. I know it's been a few months since Christmas, I think, but welcome to have you back. Just like you, theatre beginning to return, albeit in a limited capacity across the world.
I hope I'm returning in a full capacity, but no, it is really, really nice to be back. And just from listening to a lot of radio over the last couple of months, I think it's so much nicer on the air and everything when people are in studio. Mm. So, you know, little by little, normality returns. And theatre, slowly but surely, is returning internationally. One of the first industries that had to close, of course. Sadly, it's going to prove one of the last to reopen. Mm. And even in countries that have done very well in the current stages of the pandemic, that's been the case. But I have to say, it did my heart good. I think it did many people's hearts good to see Broadway, you know, reopening, to see theatre coming back to New York City. And I think it probably reflects something fundamental, you know, about the theatre, the hard time it's had in COVID and reopening, that, you know, going to the theatre is a real communal experience. Going to a play is all about the shared experience with the people beside you, behind you, and in front of you. And a three quarters empty theatre would be a very, very unnatural thing. So I think we've kind of taken our time getting theatres back open internationally, because when we get them open, we want them open properly. Mm. But an empty theatre, that was never really a problem for the theatre we're talking about today, the Pike Theatre in Dublin, because it only seated 55 members of the public, which is incredible. Okay, I think you get more people on a double-decker bus in Dublin than you could get into the Pike Theatre.
You never have a run on tickets there.
And despite its tiny, tiny size, it was one of the most influential theatres, I would say, not only in Ireland, but Europe in its day.
Really?
It hosted premieres of work by people like Samuel Beckett, Brendan Behan, and brought the best of international work to Irish audiences. I always kind of describe it as being a little bit like the IFI, you know, is the cinema to theatre. You know, it was very much an experimental European space. And our story today concerns a kind of landmark moment in Irish cultural history, a showdown in and about a theatre, but which was ultimately, I think it's probably fair to say, about much broader issues in Irish society.
Mm. We hear a lot about the culture of censorship in the early and mid part of the 20th century, and indeed we've discussed that on this lot plenty of times when it comes to different seminal works of one form or another. But censorship seemed to be something which never really applied to the whole realm of theatre.
Absolutely. Censorship brings to mind certain names, people we've looked at on the slot, like Edna O'Brien, for example. Mm. But the theatre in Ireland, curiously, kind of escaped a lot of the censorship of the 20th century that seemed to dog pretty much everything else. And I think it's just that they didn't really think about it and the need to censor. It's the one that got away, you know? So film censorship, like, we're very, very early on film censorship, even before we get down to the written word. James Montgomery, the man who, when he got the job as the first film censor in the 1920s, almost boastful, actually, about his lack of knowledge about the cinema. When he was asked what he knew about the cinema, he replied, "I know nothing about the cinema, but I know the Ten Commandments," which in 1920s okay. Ireland was enough for the job. Mm. More famously than cinema, the written word was absolutely savaged. I mean, there was the ludicrously named Committee on Evil Literature. I mean, they do sound like the bad guys, don't they? And out of that came the Censorship of Publications Board.
The funny thing is that Committee on Evil Literature sounds more like a body which was set up to propagate evil literature, doesn't it? Like, it sounds like a supervillain in a volcanic lair going, "We are going to disseminate evil literature."
And no one got away from The Catcher in the Rye to The Country Girls. You know, no one got away from the censorship of the printed word in Ireland. But no one really thought about theatre as a kind of entertainment which needed that kind of strict control. Mm. And one reason I find that very odd is that while the state didn't really think about theatre as something that needed to be censored, Irish people themselves had for a long, long time. There's a long history of Irish people getting upset about plays, disrupting them. The Playboy of the Western World, you know, the masterpiece of Singh, when that's put on in the Abbey in 1907, they actually have to bring in the big boys, you know, the broad and tall men of the Dublin Metropolitan Police, have to stand in the aisle so that play can actually go ahead. And the Freeman's Journal called it a very gross and wanton insult to the Irish people. More famously, we all remember from the Leaving Cert, the Plough and the Stars, Sean O'Casey, in 26. That's just chaos in the Abbey. There's a prostitute on stage, she's in a pub, there's a tricolour above her, and there's massive disturbances in the Abbey.
What was so offensive? Was it the fact that it was a prostitute, or the fact that she was, like, soiling the soil of a pub?
Some people insisted who were there that it was the presence of the tricolour in the drunken public house. Other people said it was the prostitute. Okay. But whatever it was, there was enough in the Plough and the Stars.
They'd have a problem going to a franchise Irish pub these days, wouldn't they?
Absolutely. They kicked off again in the Abbey in 26. So you have this history, this quite long history of, you know, theatre brawls and censorship by the people within the realm of the theatre. But the state never really thought about it. And theatre remains comparatively free of censorship in 20th century Ireland.
The Pike Theatre that you mentioned, seating a grand total of 55 patrons, pretty much nearly impossible to find, probably befitting the fact that it was so small, but it was literally shed. Yeah, in Dublin 4.
It was up a laneway, up Herbert Lane in Dublin 4. And it wasn't so much a theatre as a repurposed shed. And you can walk down Herbert Lane today, if you can find it, with no clue that this theatre was ever there. But to be honest, when it was there, it was just the same. You could walk down the lane and have no clue it was there. And, you know, to get a sense just how tiny it was, there's a great review of what it was like attending a play in the Pike. The reviewer said, "We were jammed together, tight as bricks in a wall, sweating, sticking our elbows into our neighbours, digging our knees into the people in the row in front." You know what? You'd almost be nostalgic for that kind of packed house.
I'm thinking of a pub theatre that I was in only a couple of years ago, which probably had about similar capacity. It's got a very similar vibe, but like, you'd kill to be there now in a day like today.
But it's just an extraordinary, you know, captures the mood of what it was like to be in this tiny little shed. But, you know, the theatre, though, was very, very small. It had an enormous vision. And when they opened in 53, they said, "Our policy is to present plays of all countries on all subjects, written from whatever viewpoint, provided they seem to us to be of interest and to be dramatically satisfying." Mm. So going back to that point I made earlier about, you know, comparing it to, say, the IFI, that's what it was all about. It was about bringing this kind of talent from the fringes, from the margins, into the centre of Irish public life. And they made the point that we are going to put on things that you won't see on the larger or smaller commercial stages. I'd love to know what they meant by smaller commercial stages.
Because, you know, how much smaller do you get for 55 people?
Bar someone was doing plays in the back of a truck, I don't think it's possible to have a smaller stage than the Pike. But larger obviously meant the Abbey and the like. And the people who created this tiny little bowl theatre in Dublin, Caroline Swift, a fantastic career in the Irish media over many, many decades in RTE in the decades that followed, probably best remembered for Wanderley Wagon, to which we as a nation are internally indebted to her, and her husband Alan Simpson, theatre director and, very unusually enough, an army officer. And it was Caroline and Alan Simpson who made this theatre a reality.
So if he was a theatre director but also an army officer, that meant if they had to send like lads from the Curragh in to keep order, that he'd find himself then hopelessly conflicted, not knowing which side to fall down
on. It also
on.
Meant that army intelligence were very interested in why he was hanging around with Brendan Behan so much.
Fair enough. The name, even the Pike itself, it's a name that's very evocative and provocative.
It's a brilliant name. And if you ever make your way down to the Abbey, and I cannot wait to get back into the Abbey, but the logo of the Abbey is kind of drawn from Irish folklore, and you have the Irish wolfhound and everything. It's all very evocative of the past. And the Pike did the same thing, because what is the Pike? You know, it's the weapon of the insurgent. It's carried into battle in 1798. And as they said, you know, in other words, we wanted our theatre to be a revolutionary force of small means, like the Pike, which by its ingenuity would stir up the theatrical lethargy of post-war Ireland. And really what they wanted to do was just push the boundaries of what had been seen on stage in Ireland. So they put on things like Jean-Paul Sartre, Men Without Shadows. And the way he talks about putting on Sartre in Dublin is incredible. He says, "Alan, we regularly used to have to bring out female members of the audience in a fainting condition to the lane outside, where they were draped across the bonnets of parked cars, for lack of any better means of dealing with them. Sometimes as many as 3 cars being pressed into service at any one time." These were plays which were standard fare in London or Paris, but which literally, you know, caused Irish audiences to faint.
It wasn't just fringe productions, though. I mean, there were more familiar names involved, rather, including some Nobel laureates.
Yeah, Samuel Beckett, the great Sam Beckett. I mean, I think the urban myth is that Beckett left Ireland and he never looked back. You know, better France at war than Ireland at peace. But he actually had a great grasp for Dublin, and getting his work performed in Dublin was something Beckett was very, very proud of. And then there was, of course, Brendan Behan. So the Queer Fellow, brilliant play. The Abbey actually reject Brendan Behan and the Queer Fellow, which I just find incredible. Mm. Then the Pike Theatre embrace it and they run with it instead. Waiting for Godot. And Godot just ran and ran and ran and broke all records and became the longest continuous run in Irish theatrical history to that point. Now, you know, a cynic might say it's very easy to have the longest theatrical run when you've got 55 seats in the theatre, but it was still something Beckett was very, very, very proud of. And Beckett actually writing to Simpson makes that point. He also talks about Behan as the new Sean O'Casey. So these are emerging talents, you know, in their day. People like Brendan Behan, who the Abbey were somewhat fearful of, but the Pike was willing to put them
up on
stage.
There's also the commercial aspect, I suppose, that if it's a landmark theatre and it's one that's got, you know, big staging and big audience capacity like the Abbey, you don't want to commit to putting on something for a couple of months or even for a couple of weeks if you don't think it's going to go there. But for the Pike, you know, what harm? If you don't fill 55 seats, grand, it's only 55. You've only lost a couple of nights. Along comes The Rose Tattoo, which had been a smash hit in the US, but then causes real panic when it lands on our shores.
It launches the Dublin International Theatre Festival, which was a great idea. Actually, Bord Fáilte were instrumental in this idea of a theatre festival trying to bring people to Dublin. And to be honest, it really couldn't have gone worse. Like, it went as bad as it could have gone. The Tony Award winning play, it had been on Broadway in 1951 and it ran and ran on Broadway. And for anyone who hasn't seen The Rose Tattoo, it later became a movie, quite a good movie. It's basically the story of an Italian-American widow in Mississippi. She's kind of withdrawn from the world after her husband's death. It's about love, it's about loss, it's about grief. But there's a particular scene in the play that involves a condom which falls from one character's pocket. In a panic, he kicks it under the furniture. A female character sees this and in a fury kind of kicks the man out. Okay. It's simple, it's straightforward. But not in 1950s Ireland, because condoms are basically contraband. Mm. So they didn't use one. And instead, what they used was a square of paper, which was, you know, supposed to be a condom. It was playing the role of a condom. So there isn't even a condom.
Got included in the credits. The moral panic about the presence of a condom, and in fact, there wasn't even the presence. So it was just the acknowledgement that condoms exist. Even in a scene where this condom is something which is being, you know, is contraband or being hidden in some way.
It's extraordinary. It's the idea of a condom on stage that causes this.
So they're discussing something that society opposes, and the mere fact of discussing it kicks off
a row. Enough. It's a pretend imaginary condom that, you know, brings the wheels in motion and shutting this theatre down. And the play was absolutely brilliant. I mean, the reviews are fantastic. Anna Manahan from Waterford, an incredible actress, was really coming into public prominence. But, you know, unfortunately, I think even before this thing took to the stage, it was in some people's sights.
A lot of the scandal is to be found in the National Archives today, only a stone's throw from us here now in the centre of Dublin, including some letters from the Attorney General of the day.
Yeah, and we do ourselves a great favour in this country by only releasing these things decades later. You know, every year a load of these things from the Department of Justice arrive, and it's always a big news cycle at the end of the year when we get the, I think it's the 40 years, whatever it may be, release. But the letters around The Rose Tattoo are absolutely, absolutely fantastic. So there's a letter 3 days before the run begins to the DPP from the Office of the Attorney General, noting that the Minister for Justice has been approached by a member of the Dáil, quote, with reference to the intention of the management of the Pike Theatre to produce The Rose Tattoo. The deputy stated that the play was unquestionably indecent and that its production had been prohibited in several American cities. And these released archives, I think it was 2000 that these ones came out, they basically revealed this incredible behind-the-scenes campaign from the Dáil, several TDs, the Archbishop's Palace, and across the Pike and the actors. They were kind of conscious of this in a city as small as Dublin. Even before the play took to the stage, they'd heard whispers that people were angry about it. And one actor in the production, she later recounted how, I brought a nightdress and a toothbrush with me to the theatre each night in case I would end up in Mountjoy. And then the unimaginable happens. Manahan recounted that, of course, there wasn't actually a condom in our production or even an envelope containing a condom. Yeah. There was just the art of acting. Mm. But I shall never forget that harrowing night, the absolute shock we all felt when the police arrived and took away Alan Simpson.
So Alan Simpson, who is, as you also mentioned, an army officer, ends up getting pulled away because he is staging a play in which they don't have a condom and in which the scene discusses how like non grata, how verboten a condom is. And then it becomes this nightmare for him where it drags on for the guts of a year.
It's extraordinary. Over the subsequent year, Simpson in and out of the courts, which, you know, for an army officer isn't ideal, charged with producing for gain an indecent and profane performance. The charges are eventually dropped. Yeah. But as you mentioned, the ludicrous nature of this is that it's over a non-existent condom. And it's one of the kind of long-standing urban myths of Irish theatre. It's often repeated on television and radio that the Pike was shut down over something as ludicrous as a condom on stage. But I mean, there wasn't even one.
Yeah.
So the effects...
It's not even that there wasn't one. They're producing a scene. I'm sorry I keep saying this. They're producing a scene in which the condom is seen as something which has to be other. They're not like sort of waving it around going, isn't this brilliant? They're not like...
Absolutely.
They're not singing Every Sperm is Sacred from Monty Python. They're talking about how condoms are something that they all try to pretend don't exist. And it's a scene in which it doesn't exist.
It's ridiculous. But the effects of it are very real. It's a real impact on many people involved in the theatre. And the immortal words of Brendan Behan are kind of discredited by this. Brendan said there's no such thing as bad publicity. except your own obituary. But I think the Pike learned that wasn't true. There was a total stifling of creative output. Theatres all over Dublin kind of went into a panic. What can we put on? What can't we? And as Simpson later recounted, you know, for obvious reasons, I had to avoid the presentation of any play which could possibly be considered even faintly controversial. And he put it really beautifully towards the end of his life. He said that we died so Irish theatre could be free. And the theatre had to close its doors in 1960.
It seems so jarring, especially with this kind of a 21st century understanding of what art is supposed to be, particularly when it's the theatre, that it's kind of supposed to challenge social mores to a certain degree and to make you have uncomfortable conversations, and that's what took down the Pike. Its legacy, perhaps, though, was its broad scope and its willingness to be experimental, to try new things. And although it's gone, the festival that it gave birth to still survives to this day.
We owe the Pike so much. I mean, not just Behan and Beckett, but international people like Bertolt Brecht, I mean, bringing these great talents to Irish audiences. Not very big Irish audiences, but, you know, Irish audiences nonetheless. And what I like about it, it was a playful theatre, famous for its kind of late night reviews, but also a kind of political theatre. And, you know, it's become one of the great lost theatres of Dublin. But as you rightly say, the theatre festival goes on. It's grown into something massive. This year it runs from the 30th of September to the 17th of October. And I like how they proclaim themselves that we have a rich history with much to celebrate, but we are most excited about what is yet to come. And you know what? So too were Simpson and Swift. I think they were much more interested in pushing things forward than looking backwards. But, you know, sadly, the Pike Theatre, they paid the price for it.
Hopefully when the theatre festival gets underway, as you say, from September the 30th to October the 17th, that it will be in circumstances where they can have packed houses, or at least a little bit more than 55 people in each individual theatre. What I love about this is that you could almost just call this slot, you could call it the Pike and the Rose Tattoo, and it would sound like it's a spin-off of what's the Nordic author who wrote the trilogy about the girl with the dragon, you know, all that stuff. But that it's the most quintessentially Dublin of all stories. It's brilliant stuff. Donald, pleasure to have you back in studio. Looking forward to making this a much more regular thing in future. Donald Fallon, author of the Community Books and presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast on Dublin history, which you'll find anywhere online.
On the Record with Gavin Riley.
On News Talk.